Wrapping up a very busy week, Friday style with you, April 19th, 2024, on Connecticut Today, where we took a look at the continuing nip bottle litter problem in the state. We also welcomed Scott Walter, author of Arabella, the Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America, while former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly commentary.
Well, if you're a fan of nips, if you, for some reason that I'm not really sure of, if you're a fan of nips, not nibs, not the cracker, and there are a cracker out there called nibs or something like that, N-I-B-S, but if you're a fan of the nip bottle, you know, the little 50 milliliters, 50 mLs, if you're into your metric stuff, which I still remember from high school, which shows you how much of a nerd I am. But if you are into nips, fear not. You're going to have access to them at your local liquor store and your local package store for about the next year or so at least. The nip bottle is going to stay available in Connecticut for at least another year. This story here, John Maritz's story, we start with this in the Connecticut Insider, because the General Assembly will not let local cities and towns ban nip sales. All right? Now, there's two levels here. An effort to allow cities and towns to ban the sales of nips was launched this year by Democratic state rep and former WICC news guy, I might mention, Mr. Joe Gresko, in response to years of complaints by local officials and residents about the bottles being found everywhere. How many times do you and I look down and we're walking and there's a nip bottle there? And it's even more infuriating because the bottle's 10 feet away from a public trash can. And yet somebody was at least in some modicum of crassness that they had a drink at there or throw it out the window, if you know what I mean, from their driving position, and couldn't put it in the trash. Residents are angry. They've been found at parks, ponds, beaches, and along the side of the road. So there was a proposal to allow cities and towns, which I guess has been done in other states, to say, hey, you know, if we want to, we can tell our local liquor stores no nips. Now, I know it sounds funny. There was a public hearing in February that drew supporters on both sides of the issue. Lawmakers didn't do anything further. And Joe Gresko saying as a committee chair that there wouldn't be any action on this till at least next year, when again you'll be in the long session, you'll be away from the presidential election and too far from the next round of legislative elections, so things might happen. So you have two issues here. The issue everybody is focused on, and I understand liquor stores and package stores and other sorts of stores, they make money off of these things. I get it. I understand it. I've got it. All right, you don't have to tell me there's a profit margin here. And former state rep Larry Caffaro was very active here. Larry in Norwalk here. He is the executive director of the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of Connecticut. And listen, they sell millions of these. Millions. We've talked about the numbers on these things for months and months. They sell millions of these things. So I understand there's a profit issue here. I understand there's a litter issue. And even though they put a 5-cent rebate, whatever the rebate is on this thing, these things, you know, some cities and towns are able to get money back for cleanup and environmental issues, depending upon how many they say are found in their town. I get that. I understand that. Here's the big issue in this. To me, this is the bigger issue that really, honestly, I think needs to be discussed. Why do we sell nips? Why do we sell nips? I mean, don't you think, and again, I'm not trashing anybody that sells them. there are controversial things that are sold all the time. Some people think, even though, you know, convenience stores make a ton of money on cigarettes, we shouldn't sell cigarettes. All right? And there's vocal opposition to that on both sides, and a good healthy debate on that is fine. There are people who are constantly, for example, trying to get rid of flavored vapes, right? Flavored vape capsules that, you know, the big companies like Juul, are they still around or do they go out of business because of that settlement? I'm not sure. But even the big tobacco companies are in this, saying, well, you know, it's an adult product, shouldn't be used by kids. Okay, I get that. So there's debate over cigarettes. There's debate over these vape cartridges. You know, I get that. But why do we sell nips? Now, I know some people are going to say, well, maybe somebody wants just the smaller bottle because they want to taste or sample a liquor. They don't want to buy a whole bottle, or they're using just a little bit for a couple of drinks. Maybe there are friends or relatives coming over, and I don't want to buy a whole fifth of this or a whole gallon of that. So I'll get some nip bottles. It's actually cost more money, but I'll do that. I get that. But why do we sell these things when we know? I mean, come on. I mean, we don't know, no, but we know. I mean, you mean to tell me these things aren't bought, you know, exited from the liquor store? You go back to your car, and you don't think some people are slamming these things down while they drive or right before they drive? Come on. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I'm actually disappointed, and I know there are people out there, they may be mother effing me if they run a liquor store or whatever. I'm sorry, but there are certain things that I think are fine to sell in large quantity. For example, you can sell a full pack of cigarettes or a carton. You can't sell there's a reason we don't allow cigarettes to be sold individually, or what are called loosies. Not L-U-C-Y-S, L-O-O-S-I-E-S, as in they're loose cigarettes. There's a reason we don't allow that. There's a reason we don't let legal marijuana dispensaries now sell individual joints. It's recognized as not necessary and could foster, people maybe getting access to this substance when they shouldn't. So you explain to me, why do we sell nips? Why is the sale of nips? Again, they're 50 milliliters. What is there, a shot in there, a shot and a half? I have no idea. I've never drank from a nip. I have no idea. I don't drink that much. Why do we allow that? When I'm sure if you talk to any law enforcement officer in any city or town, they're going to tell you that a lot of those nips are consumed by guys and gals either before they drive or while they're driving. I think, and I hope the General Assembly acts on this next year. And yes, I know they're a profit center for liquor stores and package stores, and I understand that. I get that. I'm not trying to keep money out of their pocket. But again, I go to convenience stores or other stores that sell cigarettes. There's a reason cigarettes are allowed to be sold and taxed by the pack or by the carton. We don't sell loose cigarettes. We don't sell loose joints. You don't go to a pharmacy, and generally, unless it's a pain medication, you don't get a script from your doctor for one or two pills, unless it's a specialized kind of medication here. I've always wondered that about the nip bottles. And look, I know there are people who are benevolent. Hey, my father-in-law comes over and he likes a shot of this if we're going to have dinner, and I don't want to buy if I buy a bottle of this for him, it's $70. I mean, I love the guy, but I'll just buy a couple of nip bottles. I'll keep them in the cabinet. Hey, Dad, how are you? Let me make you a drink. I get that. I got that. That's okay. I understand why, kind of, sort of. Right? Or maybe people are, you know, you're cooking some sort of a recipe where it calls for, you know, a very small amount of a liquor or a whiskey. I mean, I don't know. There could be 100 reasons. But again, I got to thinking about this nip thing today when I saw the bill to allow cities and towns to ban them outright got shelved for at least 1 year. And other states do this. Why do we allow nips to be sold? Now, I understand there's a market for them. For example, when you're on an airplane and the drink cart comes by, they're going to charge you $18. Here you go, sir. It's two cocktails. That'll be $37.50. What? George in Stratford. George, what's up with you? How are you?
Hey, not too bad. Hey, I got another outside-the-box perspective on this.
Okay, sure.
All right. I'm kind of a connoisseur. I'm not going to say I'm an alcoholic, but, you know, I got the taste bud. Now, on the nips, I buy the nips.
Okay.
Because what I drink is 100 proof.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
So, three nips, that's it. That's my limit.
Okay.
Now, if I have to buy a pint on this.
All right, I see where you're going. Yeah.
It's probably a problem.
I see. All right,
now,
I see where you're going.
Not just me. Yeah. There's a whole lot of other people. Now, let's just governor over here put a 5-cent deposit on this thing, which is not redeemable.
Well, there are deposits on them now.
There's deposits, a 5-cent deposit.
Yeah.
But it's not redeemable.
Yeah.
I can't take my nip back to the package store and get my 5 cents.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The money automatically goes to the cities and towns, right? You cannot redeem it. You can't redeem it like a soda bottle. Yeah, I got you. All right.
Right.
Yeah.
So I get PO'd and throw it out the window. You know?
Screw this.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And had by the government again.
So the 50 milliliter size here, which is basically about a shot or shot and a half, that to you like that because you can set your limit and you like that.
Exactly right.
All right. George,
exactly right.
I thank you for the call.
After three of them?
Yeah, good for you.
The wife's going to be PO'd at me.
Good for George, God bless you. You know your limits, and maybe that's it. All right, dark money. You hear it all the time. People on the left crying and moaning. Oh, my God. Oh, dear Jesus, the dark money on the Republican side. Well, let's talk about it from the other side, shall we? Our next guest is president of Capital Research Center. He served in the George W. Bush White House as a special assistant to the president for domestic policy, VP at the Philanthropy Roundtable, editing Philanthropy Magazine, producing donor guidebooks on how to assist the poor, public policy research, and other topics. He's testified on dark money nonprofits to the U.S. House, the Senate, the IRS, and state legislatures. The guest is Scott Walter. The name of the book is Arabella, The Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America. Scott, hi. It's Paul at WICC in Connecticut. How are you?
Great to be with you, Paul.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. We appreciate the few minutes. The Arabella, has a nice soft name to it. But describe or define for my audience what the Arabella Network is or the organization is. Who is involved up front here and why should we be wary of this?
Sure. You got it right when you called it a network. It's a network of different groups. Various different groups, but the easiest way to understand it is think of a pyramid. At the top, you have Arabella Advisors, right? That's a for-profit consulting PR firm, mm-hmm. right? That controls and creates the rest of the things down the pyramid. Now, in the middle of the pyramid, you have half a dozen nonprofits of different types, and that's where the money goes from, you know, a George Soros or mm-hmm. a Zuckerberg or Bill Gates. They write checks into those nonprofits. But then at the base of the pyramid, that's what you see. That's what ordinary Americans see. Hundreds and hundreds of fake groups with names like, you know, Floridians for a Fair Shake and Opportunity Wisconsin, whatever. They look like they're grassroots advocacy groups. But in fact, they're just a website and an accounting code back in a D.C. office.
So you're saying that for at least some of these groups, Scott, if I tried to go to a brick-and-mortar storefront or say, hey, where are these offices, I wouldn't be able to find some of them or not?
That's exactly right. They don't have boards of directors. They don't file IRS reports like a normal nonprofit. They're just a project of one of those mid-level nonprofits that Arabella is running.
So let me cut to the chase here. Is this patently illegal? Is it legal? Do they subsist in some sort of fundraising purgatory here, Scott? Is this a gray area that they've been able to gain? Talk about that.
Well, in principle, what I just described is legal. Now, in the case of Arabella, however, they have a very serious lawsuit against them by a former employee who alleges that they were violating the rules governing complex nonprofit arrangements like this. And the other problem is that they've been taking for two decades, since the beginning, they've been taking hundreds of millions of dollars from another George Soros that you haven't heard of, Hans-Jürg Wyss, a Swiss billionaire who is a foreign national and not allowed to mess in our politics. But he's been giving them hundreds of millions.
So, okay, now this is a little more in focus here. So are you saying that, and in your book, is there evidence here, or is there known evidence here in testimony, Scott, that foreign influencers are kind of putting this money in the machine, letting it swish around and trickle down, if you will, to these organizations to kind of immunize themselves from accusations that these are foreigners interfering in domestic affairs?
Yes and no, right? So this guy, Wyss, we know, you can go into FEC records and see for yourself in the Federal Election Commission records. At one point, he was writing checks, a total of over $100,000, to actual hard dollar political things like Friends of Dick Durbin, right? That is absolutely illegal. And unfortunately, he wasn't caught until the statute of limitations expired. In more recent years, he's been smarter. He's been writing checks to Arabella's nonprofits. Now, that can be legal, but they shouldn't then be using that money to bring it into a ballot initiative in your state or hand it to a super PAC, right? Because he can't write a check to a super PAC. So the question is, when he writes it to one of their nonprofits and the nonprofit then writes it to a super PAC, is it really his money or not? And that's a gray area.
The interesting name of the book, Arabella, the Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America. Scott Walker is the guest. You know, Scott, on your cover here, we see, obviously, and I think most people would recognize George Soros. To the left of him, you have Bill Gates. To the right of him, Mark Zuckerberg. Now, you just mentioned some gentlemen that, frankly, and I do this for a living, I've never heard of. Who are some, Scott Walker, of the other men and women who are powering this Arabella organization that are trying to influence the U.S. to an extent that people may not know? They may not be daily or household names, but are trying to have an effect here. Name some of those.
Sure. Another one would be Pierre Omidyar, who is a billionaire thanks to his eBay work. Another is actually Warren Buffett, whom I imagine most of your folks have heard of. He uses Arabella. What you probably don't know is he's one of the biggest abortion advocates, well, is the biggest abortion advocate really in the whole country, and has sent millions and millions of dollars into Arabella for that purpose.
Scott, let me give you something, and I use this kind of promoing your appearance last hour. We always hear, the dark money of the right wing, the NRA and the Koch brothers when they were both alive, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So, Scott, what would be your response to, and I'm sure there are people listening to me right now, I do have many progressive listeners who are saying, hey, what's the big deal? You guys on the right do it all the time. What's your response to that?
Well, of course, thanks to the poor quality of our media, few people understand that the left is the party of the rich, period. And dark money, of course, now has like several, nobody carefully defines it anymore. But all the different ways you can count the money, there's more on the left than the right, period. And I've documented that in my testimony to Congress time after time. No Democrats ever asked me a question when I was testifying to try to disprove that, which probably tells you all you need to know.
So, so I was just going to ask you that. So when you're is that kind of a tacit, is that giving the message of, Oh, geez. This guy that's lecturing us here, he's giving us the facts. He really knows his stuff, so we're just going to, you know, keep our mouths shut here. Is that kind of the vibe that you've gotten looking at Democrats in D.C. when you're telling him about this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I've testified repeatedly to the biggest left-wing Democrat money, you know, anti-dark money hawk, Sheldon Whitehouse, four times at this point. He can't even look me in the eye. But and by the way, I will, to be fair to the mainstream media, they have started noticing this. And so you can actually find, for instance, Politico and the New York Times admitting there's more dark money on the left, because it's so out of balance at this point, it's just laughable.
What is, and I know this, we could probably talk for hours on this, what is the goal of George Soros? And now his son is taking over, and in fact, you probably have seen this. You know, he's buying his big next push here. You've probably seen this is radio and talk radio, with concentrations of stations he's buying up and getting into the Odyssey company of broadcast. What is he? I find him fascinating. Is how, Scott, he could be so fixated on just funding every single leftist group that he can. What does Soros get out of this?
You know, well, even people with a lot of power and money can always lust for more power and money. And the one pattern that you'll see, and you know, when we study the left like this and their funding, there's one very simple pattern. They do not want your listeners. They do not want you to have more power. They want you to have less. They want you to be silenced. They want the power to be centralized, where it's easier for them to grab and control it. And that's just the pattern over and over again.
And the fact that, and luckily, Scott, it looks like maybe in some areas, maybe after hosts like me crying and screaming on TV and radio, maybe some people are finally waking up to some of these leftist, criminal-loving DAs that this guy has financed. I mean, some of them are being recalled now, so maybe, hopefully, crossed fingers, the fascination here with some of these people is finally awakening some people around the country.
Well, I hope so. You know, capitalresearch.org, we are the best place in the country for information on the Soros DAs. But to connect it back to Arabella, that network that the book's about, I hate to tell you, but most of the Zuckerberg money to Arabella has gone for criminal justice reform, quote unquote, which is to say the same kind of turn them loose junk that all those Soros DAs are doing. So it's terrible to realize there's another billionaire pushing that same crazy line.
Who is there any, and I know the surviving Koch brother is out there, but as you say, it's imbalanced now, Scott Walter. Is anybody pushing back on this money-wise and influence-wise on the right, saying, hey, no, we're not going to let America get pushed around like this in our ideals? Is there anybody fighting this money-wise, or is the fight just becoming tougher and tougher?
You know, there certainly are some conservative donors. It's not like there's no money on the other side. On the other hand, there's nothing to equal the colossal size of Arabella's network. In 2022 cycle, they took in $3 billion.
Wow.
Nobody on the right can claim anything close to that.
Yeah, it is funny, Scott. You and I look like we're about the same age. Remember like 10, 15, 20 years ago? And obviously, you know, when you were in the Bush White House, remember, Scott, we always used to hear, oh, big money in politics. Oh, we got to get the money out of this. Oddly silent is about half the country on that right now. Isn't that kind of weird? They don't, suddenly we don't talk about that anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like you can tell the Electoral College gets attacked if a Republican wins with it. When
exactly.
Bill Clinton won with the Electoral College, there wasn't a problem then.
The name of the book, once again, pick it up, folks, Arabella, A-R-A-B-E-L-L-A, Arabella, the Dark Money Network of Leftist Billionaires Secretly Transforming America. On the cover, three mugs you know out there. We've got Mark Zuckerberg, we've got George Soros, and we've got Bill Gates. Scott Walter has been the guest. Scott, any websites or social media you want to tell my listeners about?
Sure. Our main site is capitalresearch.org. You can sign up for a weekly greatest hits of our research. And influencewatch.org is an online encyclopedia of the left.
All right. Influencewatch.org and capitalresearch.org. Hey, Scott, thank you. Continue good luck, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, folks. But every week around this time, to wrap up the week and send us flying off into the weekend, telling us everything will be okay, former Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso of Bridgeport joins us. Chris, how are you?
Happy Friday to you, Paul.
We made it again, Chris. We made it again. There's a bunch of stuff going on. What has tickled what has tickled your fancy this week, Mr. Caruso?
Well, a couple of things. One is that the State Elections Enforcement Commission has forwarded to the Chief State's Attorney's Office investigation concerning the absentee ballot use in Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it's criminal. And that means that there's going to be a further investigation by that agency. And most likely charges will be made to those individuals who violated the absentee ballot laws in the state. So I think that bodes well for the people of Bridgeport, that those who were involved in absentee ballot abuse will be brought to justice. And I think that's critically important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, I mean, something has to be done. Listen, they can do the minutiae and the machinations of how long a sentence would be. But the voters, Chris, there has to be, we have to get serious about this. The silly season has to end on this. It has to.
You're absolutely right, Paul, and I think this is a good step. If you remember back in 2019, the State Elections Enforcement Commission had complaints of absentee ballot abuse, and they really didn't move it along until 3 or 4 years later. This is much more timely, so I think they're taking it seriously. I think, you know, they feel that the Chief State's Attorney's Office has a lot more resources, investigative powers, and I think that bodes well. And you keep in mind, the state's attorney's office is the criminal arm, if you will, of the judicial system. So this isn't a civil case. These are criminal matters, and I think that's important. And you know, we're going to see, you know, if you remember this presidential primary in Bridgeport, there were hardly any absentee ballots cast.
Mm-hmm.
It was just people went to the polls. So it shows that, you know, if you do it fairly and you don't go out and try to get everyone to do an absentee ballot, the elections can be done fairly. But I think the legislature needs to watch to see what happens with this situation and then put laws in place that are going to be really enforced and much stronger than they currently are. I think that's critical. I think you're right, Paul. I think you've been right on the mark on this when it comes to fairness of elections and, you know, that people feel that their vote counts. We've got to take strong corrective action. We have to enforce the laws, or they will mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah. A sidebar story here that fascinated me, Chris. Yesterday in the Hearst Publications, our buddy Brian Lockhart, the state Supreme Court is weighing. I love this, Chris. Can I get this job?
Yeah.
If Bridgeport voters can make citizens arrests and arrest an absentee ballot scandal, there's a gig for you, Chris. You can be the sheriff Bridgeport and arrest people. This is kind of an interesting case, I think.
Well, you know, Paul, in many situations, a citizen can arrest someone if they see a crime taking place, and they have that power, you know, under statute. So this could be another one. If you're at a polling place and you see someone violating the law, let's say they're putting more than one ballot in the voting machine, they could probably, and the Supreme Court will decide on this, but they may have the ability to, you know, say to the person, you know, you're being held, we're going to call the police and pursue this matter immediately. And I think that, again, has to be reviewed by the Supreme Court because of, you know, individual rights and freedoms and so forth that always have to be weighed. But if you saw someone committing a crime as a citizen, you have a right to hold that person until the police come, you know, based on crime. I know there's certain crimes are different, but there is that ability. So why not when it comes to elections? You know, who better than voters in the polling places? If they see someone violating the law, Well, why not blow the whistle? Do it then, right, while it's happening. I think that's critical. Yeah, I'm not opposed to that stuff, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've become a society where individualism has become so much on everything we do that, you know, we got to get back to some sense of community, that if an election's being robbed, it's not only affecting just one individual, it's affecting the larger community. You know, I had a mom and dad that were, grew up during the Depression, mm-hmm. World War II.
Yep.
There was a real sense by that generation of community. And, you know, what one person did mattered to someone else. There were standards or expectations.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost a lot of that today, and I think we need to get back to it. I remember my mother telling me so many times, listen, you have the right to choose, but understand with every choice there's a consequence.
Yep.
And even when it came to the police and all, I remember my mother telling me, Christopher, and when she was mad at me, she always called me Christopher. And, you know, she said, Christopher, if you get arrested, you're going to sit in jail. I'm not coming down to bail you
out.
You're going to sit there, right? And, you know, that put the fear of God in me. And, you know, it's just something that needs to be said, that we don't do that today. It's kind of hand, you know?
My mother used to say, Chris, and the guest, of course, is Chris Caruso with his weekly wrap-up. My mother used to say that when the beat cops in New Haven used to come into her neighborhood in the Hill section of New Haven, which was very ethnic, a lot of Italian, Jewish families, Irish families, Polish yep. families, whatever. Like,
yeah.
when the cop turned the corner, walking a beat and flipping that billy club around there, and he told you to break it up on the corner, you broke it up. You did. You sitting on a stoop or loitering, even back then, no, you didn't do that.
Yeah.
She said, no, you
and
when
you know,
when the cop said ran, you say when the cop said run, you said how fast? Yeah.
And you know, Paul, it wasn't just with cops; it was with teachers. I remember when the nuns at school, at one time they put soap in my mouth, me and about three other kids. And I went home, and my mother's only remark was, what did you do? That was the question. It wasn't what did the nun do, it was what did you do? And then I'd get a smack sometime, you know? But you know, that was part of life, and you understood right from wrong. Today, there's such a blur of that going on. And adults afraid to say something to kids. It's kind of gotten to a point where it's a little bit out of control, Paul, you know?
Yeah. Finally, Chris, we're getting into what I hope doesn't become silly time in Hartford.
Yeah.
The short session ends, I think, on May 8th. And we're starting to see, Chris, over the last few days, bills that are not going to get any further action, some bills not out of committee. So you were up there for years and years, and I can just imagine what kind of, you know, scramble time here, because we have this constitutional deadline here. And what bothers me, Chris, and this probably bothered you, I would think, is just because of time, needed stuff wasn't done, and stuff that was done might have been done a little on the sloppy side.
Well, you know, Paul, the truth of it is the legislature is like a funnel. And, you know, at the beginning of the session, they put all those bills in. There's thousands of bills, and you put it into the funnel, and it gets to the neck of the funnel, and then slowly some bills come out and some don't.
Yeah.
I would say, though, 95% of the time, the bills that die deserve to die.
Yeah.
They probably had no reason to be even in the system, but you've got to go through the process, that democratic process, which is fine. But the bills that actually come out are better because they're scrutinized more, and the most important things actually do pass. And there's different ways you can do it. You know, you can take a bill, you can add it to the budget, you can add it to different ways. So the bills that really are meant and are good to pass do happen, but a lot of the ones that are ridiculous and foolish, they end up dying, you know, on the vine as we go along. Now, I have to applaud the legislature and the House of Representatives in particular at the state capitol. A unanimous vote on taking vehicles, those terrain vehicles and dirt bikes, and taking them. You know, years ago, I passed a bill on illegal dumping that if someone was caught in the act of illegal dumping, if you took their license plate and you were able to prove that they were illegal dumping, you could confiscate the vehicle. And I think that was critically important. And in this case, it's the same thing. If you want to drive illegally, if you want to cause mayhem, if you want to create traffic problems and you're doing that illegally, the the bike should be taken away from you. So I was happy that the legislature stepped up and did something. And you know the reason it did, Paul? It wasn't a city issue, and it wasn't a suburban issue. It's a statewide issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear that in the debate from the legislators, that this was something that affected every constituency. And I applaud them because that needed to be done. I've been in traffic, Paul, where these dirt bikes come up on both sides of me.
Yeah.
You know, they slow down, they speed up. I've seen vehicles almost hit the kids on these bikes. So, you know, I applaud them. You know, and when politicians do something right, we need to step up and we need to applaud it. And I think this is one example that you get tough on this. And, you know, the way you're going to stop it is by taking those vehicles away. That's what's really going to have the major deterrent, is that you can actually take and confiscate, those bikes that shouldn't be on the road in the first place.
And I was shocked. Wasn't it, at least in the House, Chris, wasn't that a unanimous vote? You never, unless it's renaming a post office, do you ever see unanimous votes, right?
No, you know, we used to see it, Paul, when we named, Pumpernickel Bread Day. That's when we got unanimous votes at all.
Right.
But no, this is rare. And again, it was urban legislators, suburban, rural. This cut across all parties, all lines, all divisions. And it said, hey, this is a statewide issue that we need to correct. And thank God that the legislature stepped up and did it. And they're going to give some powers to the municipalities, which makes sense. But I'm so happy they did it, because, you know, if we ever hit someone on one of those bikes, Paul, you know, our insurance rates go up. The other thing is, we may hurt a kid that's on a bike, which no one wants to do. But when a kid is weaving in and out of traffic and is on a bike that's illegal, it doesn't even come under the Department of Motor Vehicles, you know, they're asking for trouble. And so I'm really happy that the legislature stepped up. And it wasn't milquetoast. This is pretty tough when they can take the bike. There's also, I believe, the ability to remove someone's license, you know, as a result of it. So there's enough deterrence in there that I think it's going to send a message. But most importantly, it's going to give the police the opportunity to have another tool in the arsenal to really correct this problem. They haven't had that before. And part of it is, if they pulled them over, there was very little they could do. Well, this gives them the tool now to actually bring things back under control. I have seen, unfortunately, across the state, I've seen it in my city where I live, I've seen it in other communities, I've talked to others, there's been a lawlessness that has almost been allowed to exist. It's almost, you know, just turn your head and don't say anything, as long as it's not affecting you personally. But that lawlessness only grows. It only gets worse. Those who just violate the law feel empowered to do it, and it's time that we start, you know, getting back to some common sense. And if you break the law, you're punished for it. There has to be a consequence, Paul. I'm a Democrat, and people say, well, you're a Democrat and saying that. No. This is about common sense. It's about practicality, and it's what should be. You know, every person, in a free society, you can make choices, but understand there's a consequence at the end of the day, and a person has to be held. If the rule of law, Paul, if our Constitution is going to mean anything, then we've got to enforce the laws. But we have to make the laws in such a way that people are held accountable. It's just, to me, common sense. You know?
Absolutely. Great thoughts to end the week. Chris Caruso. Chris, have a great weekend, and we'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Paul. Take care now.
All right. There you go.